90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, also on cgsf.ca, and TELUS TV, channel 7014. Hello and thank you to all the affiliates and syndicates across the country. Well, as you know, many of you listen to the show, I'm a big fan of books and literature, and we've had countless authors on over the years. And with the Giller Prize ceremony coming up on Tuesday, November 10th, I thought we would do a Giller Prize special. I had a chance to speak with three of the nominees, Miriam Taves, Shawn Michaels, and Padma Viswanathan, at different points throughout this year. And they are three of the six nominees for the Giller Prize this year, so I thought we would air their interviews in honor of that. My first interview is with Shawn Michaels, the author of Us Conductors, which tells a fictionalized fictionalized version of Leon Lef Theremin, who was the inventor of the theremin. And I sat down with Shawn back in May. So I'm here with Shawn Michaels, the author of Us Conductors. Shawn, hello.
Hello.
So, Us Conductors, what made you decide that you wanted to write about Leon Theremin and the theremin?
It was one of those stories that I think it was a story that I stumbled into kind of through the back way. I heard a version of the true history, sort of a thumbnail sketch of Leon's story, Leon and Clara's story. And it was just rattling around in my head. But the more and more that I read about it and learned about it, it suddenly started to really chime with all sorts of other ideas that I had in my head about the sorts of stories that I'm interested in or that I was interested in telling. I've always really loved stories that seem extraordinary, you know, the ordinary seeming extraordinary. And so whether that's the fantastical kind of crossing real life or real life just suddenly strangely crossing into the fantastical, and their story from the kind of love affair of it or just the inventions that Theremin invented or just the canyons and the mountains and valleys of his life were all to me just so impossible, and I like telling these. I'm attracted to these stories that are quietly impossible.
Given your sort of your background in music journalism, was it always a foregone conclusion that you were going to make it a novel? Did you ever consider writing more of a nonfiction profile of Theremin?
Yeah, not at all. I've always been. In fact, I'm a fiction writer first. Although being a novelist is one of those very slow, slow processes. I've wanted to write fiction all my life. And when I started writing music criticism, I was already trying to write short stories and so on. But that's a much slower game to get off the ground. So it was really over the course of slowly honing my fiction writing that I tumbled into becoming a successful music journalist. And so I love fiction first and music journalism second. And so the idea of writing a nonfiction book is quite almost a little bit horrifying to me. I don't know. I like lying to. I'm too interested in a beautiful lie over a sturdy truth.
Given that you're writing a fictional story about a real person, how careful are you to keep certain elements of his life intact, as opposed to just making everything up?
I didn't feel a responsibility. For me, it really wasn't, in a way, as much as it's easy as shorthand if I'm describing the book or in the press materials that it's a book about a real person. It's really a book inspired by a real person's story, and I like to think that I sort of took his story and then danced away from it and did my own little dance, or kind of a dreamed-up version of his life. And I've always been very explicit with myself that was the project. And so from the start, for instance, in my book, one of my early decisions was to make Leon a practitioner of kung fu, which is an absurd invention of mine. And to me, that was a way of like waving this huge flag that says, look, this is not my version of the true story. This is like a really, this is something that sits, that goes off down its own garden path away from the true story. So I didn't feel a responsibility to be faithful to him. I did feel a responsibility to make it very clear that I wasn't being faithful so that nobody would confuse my story for the truth or judge him according to the fiction that I tell.
No one would actually think that he was a kung fu master.
Right, or a murderer. In this in this book, there's a murder that is not part of Tarman's real story at all. You know, I'd hate for people to say, oh, like, confront him for that invented crime.
Right. The theremin itself is one of the most interesting musical instruments. Prior to writing this story, what sort of experience did you have with it, if any?
So I had seen the theremin on stage with, you know, like indie rock, arty indie rock bands. I'd heard it in movies as this kind of sci-fi sound effect. But I did have this. A few years before writing the book, I had a very different experience where I was driving one night in the car. I turned on the CBC and was listening to this beautiful aria, this soprano singing piece of opera music. And then at the end of the segment, the host said that was a thereminist called Peter Pringle playing that aria on a theremin. So it wasn't actually, I thought I was hearing a woman singing, and it was actually a virtuoso thereminist. And that really upended my understanding of the theremin away from being this kind of novelty act and towards the understanding its capacity to be something very beautiful and almost unearthly. And I think that really, once I understood this sort of strange device that's a complicated, easily like a fallible piece of engineering that is able to communicate this almost impossible beauty, I really became attracted to it, and also attracted to it as a metaphor for all sorts of other aspects of our kind of fallible lives that aspire towards a more beautiful, pure thing.
Do you think, or how do you think Tarman and his invention changed the scope of music at all, given that, you know, the theremin's sort of this, the first truly electronic instrument, if you will?
Well, he really introduced the Western world to the idea of electronic sounds, and kind of a siren-y alarm clock sound that we're now so familiar with, that electric tone. He was really, for many people, the first introduction to that. And so in that way, it was really revolutionary, and its effects go on today. But on the other hand, the theremin was a flop, as my book kind of tells some of the story of that flop. It was a flop for a number of reasons, but I actually think that in some ways the modern or contemporary electronic, just modern music with the electric guitar was a response to the failure of the theremin. So because the theremin was such a commercial failure, so many of the future electronic instrument inventors wanted to make something that was very, very different. And so something like the success of the electric guitar or of the synthesizer, to me, was a reflection of the theremin. You know, you want to make something that doesn't look or really sound or feel like the theremin. And so in a funny way, I think that if the theremin had been successful, we'd have a very different... It's like the theremin's responsible for the sound of today's music by having failed.
Do you think it failed because it was invented too early? It was ahead of its time?
I think that contributed, or rather the fact that the theremin feels somehow impossible and futuristic, no matter what era you seem to be in, I think that's something that has contributed to its failure. Even today, the reason that it's not more familiar to people is it looks like this kind of... It looks like something someone invented up, someone dreamed up, some mad scientist in a lab. It's an instrument that you play without touching. You know, you just wave your hands in the air and it makes this strange sound. And it's hard to really think of that becoming mainstream when it still feels so futuristic.
So, you obviously, as we mentioned earlier, got your start in music journalism before you found success as a novelist. And yours was actually one of the first music blogs out there. Mm-hmm. How do you think both music and music you know, journalism, music critique has changed since you first started your blog?
Well, when I started my blog, which is called Said the Gramophone, in 2003, there was very little, there were very few people on the internet writing about music that you could actually, at that moment, hear. So, I mean, there were people obviously writing about music, but MP3s were still kind of these clumsy, big files. People were intimidated. Downloading an MP3 was still a kind of a big deal. You weren't doing it, or you weren't downloading huge movie files and MP3s all the time. So we were one of the first blogs where you could read about a song and also download it or hear it for yourself. And so to me, that really opened up the potential to do something really interesting with writing about music, something different, where instead of describing what the music sounds like, i.e., oh, there's banjos here and it sounds a bit like country music with Bob Dylan, you could describe a more abstract and personal response to the music. You could describe your experience of hearing the music. And I found this fascinating. It was a really interesting way to, reading other people doing that, suddenly it gave me a new and really personal way into the music that I was being introduced to. But in the years since then, I kind of hoped that you'd have all these bloggers and people writing these really personal excavations or of the music that they love and kind of sharing these personal experiences with music. And instead, we have less and less and less and less personal writing about music. And as YouTube videos and MP3s have become more disposable or like easily passed around, all it is people proclaiming the existence of music with almost no personal response. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, didn't that go to the fact that society as a whole has become less personable and more automated in a sense?
I mean, that's an interesting thought, that there's something about where we're narrating our lives kind of more glibly.
And through technology, you know, the evolution of technology has given rise to a greater disconnect between people and humanity.
Yeah, we're not having long conversations necessarily about ourselves or about art. We're having very, very short little blurts of conversation that can be transmitted easier or browsed more easily through our devices. Yeah.
If Terman was alive today, what do you think he would say about sort of the state of music and the state of society?
Well, I think that if the Terman of my book were alive today, he would be thrilled at how much kind of invention and innovation there is going on the internet, but also really disappointed at the kind of the small-mindedness of it, that we don't have more people who are actually inventing new objects, new machines to transform. We all become so interested in software and websites that live on the machines, and I think he was always a real big idea machines guy. How can we really change things with a new machine? What experiences or aspects of the world are we not yet exploiting properly? So I think he would have loved all these people who are working on it, but also been disappointed that it was mostly people just, you know, making apps. I don't think Terman would have been an app guy, at least not my version of him.
You talked earlier about the personal response to music. So who are some artists in some music that speaks to you at this point in your life right now?
It's really changing all the time, and week to week and moment to moment. It's funny how you get, I think everyone's like this, where they get caught down little rabbit holes of familiar music or new music. This week I was really going crazy for this Alicia Keys song from like 3 or 4 years ago, it's neither fresh music nor particularly cool music nor particularly old music. It was none of these things. It's a really great song. I've always been fascinated by musicians who are able to kind of epitomize a feeling, like really capture a distilled emotion, and yet they're also, the feeling lands a little bit wrong. So it's both like this perfect version of a feeling, but also slightly an unfamiliar version of it, and kind of points you down this new direction. And I don't know, that Alicia Keys song was doing that for me. I also really love, I've been listening a lot to African music from Mali and the Niger, that I have to react to in a more visceral level than I would if I could understand all the lyrics. Well, I don't speak those
languages. There are great musicians. One comes to mind, Ambadou and Mariam, great Malayan couple.
Absolutely.
But who, on a similar note, who do you, are you think there's anybody out there that's making innovative music? You know, because it could be good music, but not necessarily change the game at all. Is there anyone that sticks out in your mind in that regard who's really changed the face of music in the last couple of years?
Well, there is someone that I think has had a big... Well, if I think about future music, sometimes I think about... There's two artists that come to mind. One is English producer, a musician called Mika Levy, who has a project called Mikachu and the Shapes, and she just got a lot of fame because she did the soundtrack for this new Scarlett Johansson movie, Under the Skin. And it's this, she really loves using like vacuum cleaners and all this weird kind of dark, industrial, noisy, like droney machine sounds to kind of make pop music. And I think that it really feels very weird and unfamiliar and fresh. And I'm interested to see how that, I think it is starting to trickle down to things like hip-hop and these weird samples that reflect that. And the other person is Nicki Minaj, who's like a huge international star. But sometimes when I'm listening to one of her poppy singles, I can barely wrap my head around what's going on. And I think, oh, the kids today for whom this is like mainstream accessible music, it really speaks to how weird music can get very quickly, how it runs away from us.
Well, the book is Us Conductors, Shawn Michaels. It's out now. If you're interested in music, history, or you just like a good read, everyone should check it out. Shawn Michaels, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And that was Shawn Michaels, author of the book Us Conductors, the first of our Giller Prize-nominated writers. We are going to hear now a song from a group called Brishin, fronted by a great friend of me and Endeavor's, Quinn Bashand. You may remember Quinn and his sister Christina being on here a couple of times discussing their duo together. Quinn is in a new group, Brishin, which is described as a gypsy jazz group. It also features Richard Moody, Ruben Weir, and Joey Smith. This is their self-titled album, and the first song you're going to hear is Annie's Waltz, which features Adrian Dolan on the accordion. Thank you. That was Quinn Michon and Brishan with Annie's Waltz, and you'll be hearing more from them later on in the show. Our second Giller Prize nominated writer this evening is Miriam Taves. Her previous books include A Complicated Kindness, which won Canada Reads back in 2006, and Irma Voth. Her new book is All My Puny Sorrows, which is inspired a lot in part by the death of her sister. I had a chance to speak with Miriam Taves back in.
On the phone with me now is author Miriam Taves. Miriam, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
The new book is All My Puny Sorrows. And I'm wondering how much of this book came from, you know, the life and death of your sister at all.
Well, a lot of it, clearly. I mean, that was the time before her death and the death itself and the time afterwards was a huge, difficult, important time in my life that I needed and made me think about a lot of things and I had a lot of questions. So a couple of years after she died, I started writing the book. So that is definitely the raw material of the book, but there are some other things too. It's fiction, it's a novel.
But did that make the writing process easier or harder for you, would you say?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, it was something. I mean, writing is something that I need to do. That sounds like a cliche this way, but it is something that I need to do. It's how I process things, and it's the thing that I will continue to do, I hope. So the writing itself, I mean, when you're writing a book like this, in any book, you have to kind of detach yourself a little bit from the emotional reality in order to stay focused and to create something artful and beautiful, hopefully. That's the goal. So in a way, I could remain a little bit distanced from the pain of the actual experience while I was writing it, but then on the other hand, it was obviously front and center as well, because that's what I was writing about.
This book deals with suicide, or at the very least, suicide attempts. So, did you go anywhere in terms of researching facts about suicide and sort of, you know, people who suffer from depression at all?
Well, I mean, I've read an awful lot about suicide and non-fiction books about it and studies and reasons and maybe some scientific stuff, and I've read fiction dealing with suicide, but ultimately, I mean, it's one of those things. It's one of those deaths that's exceptional that leaves the survivors with so many questions, and there's a lot about it that we still don't know.
How would you describe your writing process as a whole?
I think I'm a writer. It's what I've always done, and it's for me it's just a natural, you know, it's an artistic impulse, or you know, to take things. Take stuff from my life, from the world, the things that I experience, the things I feel, and shape them into narrative. And so, you know, that's what my books are, and that's my process.
It's interesting because although you were sort of interested in writing as a kid, you never thought of yourself as having literary ambitions. When did you finally decide? It's like, okay, yes, this is me.
Yeah, that's true. When I was a kid, it seemed like an impossible thing. It just didn't even occur to me that I could become a writer. But I had studied journalism back in the early 90s, and so when I graduated from journalism school, I was working as a freelance making radio documentaries, and so I was working on a piece about mothers on social assistance, single mothers, and the whole welfare climate in Canada, and And I thought then that story would probably make a better, I would be able to get to certain truths and a better understanding of that world through fiction. So that's when I decided to attempt to write a novel.
And you haven't stopped since. I mean, how would you you mentioned there that, you know, you started off doing radio documentaries, and how different would you say, cuz I mean, they're both about telling stories, you know, in the grand scheme of things, but how would you say those two worlds differ, the radio documentaries from the novel writing?
Well, I mean, radio documentaries, you know, you're exploring the lives of other people, and you're coming at it from your own perspective, obviously, and with your own stuff, your own values and experiences, but and writing a novel is kind of more of a you know, getting inside your own head, into your thoughts, and somehow trying to express the stuff that is there, you know, honestly and intelligently. But also radio documentary. I mean, you know, with radio docs, you can't really make stuff up. And in fiction, of course, you can. So there's more freedom for sure writing fiction.
How much of your creative output would you say was inspired by your upbringing in Steinbeck?
I'm not sure. I do think about that. I'm asked that, and I think that certainly. So for Mennonites, I mean, you know, a lot of the kind of just typical art forms that we have today were not acceptable in those types of very conservative Mennonite communities. So, but writing was something that you could do by yourself, you know, kind of hidden away. It was sort of a subversive act, and nobody needed to know about it. And there you had still expressed yourself on the page. So I think that there's something about those communities that does encourage writing. Just as a means of expression, because for a lot of people in those communities, silence is sort of that idea that what you have to say is necessarily, you know, that important, particularly for women.
Although I'm sure growing up in a Mennonite community helped you when you were asked to do Silent Light.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, definitely. Yes, I mean, that movie was shot in northern Mexico in a very, very, very old order Mennonite community, and I didn't grow up in one of those, but still, I mean, the people, when I got there, I felt very much at home. The language was the same, and the people, you know, we kind of looked alike, and we had similar names, and it was very familiar on the one hand and very exotic on the other.
How did you find being an actress?
Oh, well, it was kind of a break from my work. It was a little bit of a holiday because it wasn't my story. I didn't have to put it together. I didn't have to think about it. I didn't have to work at it. I just had to do what the director told me to do, and try not to, you know, laugh and waste film. So it was, in that way, it was a little bit of a relief. It was intense. It was really, really intense. I mean, the conditions of that, the circumstances of that film were kind of shot in northern Mexico, and there were clashes, there were conflicts. But it was, I learned an awful lot.
Do you think you'll act again?
No, I really doubt it. Nobody's asked me. I'm not sure. I can just act on my own. But I prefer writing.
You mentioned the language in that film, Plaudisch, Mennonite Low German. For you, you know, as a writer and someone who grew up in a Mennonite community, what was it like getting back in touch with that language?
Yeah, again, it felt very familiar to me. It was sort of, you know, this is nice. This reminds me of my childhood, really. I mean, now I don't hear the language very often because I live in Toronto, and my mother lives with me, but she speaks the language, but I don't speak it. I don't understand, so we converse in English. And so, you know, hearing it just reminded me of my childhood when I was surrounded by people who spoke it.
I know you wrote Irma Voth, you know, that was directly inspired by your experience on Silent Light, but do you ever think about maybe using the Plaudisch language in a future story of yours?
You mean writing a novel in that language?
Yeah, or you know, or at least incorporating it into a novel.
I don't know. I mean, I do. There are splashes of it in this book that I wrote, A Complicated Kindness. You know, there are a few phrases and words there, but you know, it's an unwritten language. So whenever you're spelling a word or from that language, you kind of just do it phonetically, and so I'm not sure how easy it would be. Plus, I don't speak it, so, and I'm not sure that there would be a huge readership. Not that I'm necessarily going for a huge readership, but yeah, it's problematic.
So, getting back here to you know, to all my puny sorrows. Obviously, this is, you know, this is a relationship about two sisters, and it's really about love. I would surmise. What, you know, both personally and creatively, what is love to you?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm not sure I have any easy answers. I mean, love, you know, presented in the context of the book, it's something that both sisters feel an enormous amount of for each other, and from that love, I think conventional wisdom thinking is that we do whatever we can to help to reduce the suffering of the people that we love. That's part of our responsibility to those that we love. So, but in this case, with Elfrida wanting to die and begging her sister Yolandi to help her, you know, if you love me, you would help me, she says. And Yolandi is really forced to think about that, to think about, yeah, what does love mean in that situation? And so that's one of the questions in the book.
Especially out here in BC, there's been a lot of coverage lately on, you know, the debate surrounding assisted suicide and the right to die movement. Given the subject material of your book, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that it's the conversation that more Canadians are becoming comfortable with. It's a really complicated issue, obviously, and it's not something that a lot of people really want to think about, but you know, I think when we do realize, accept our own mortality, we realize that we're all going to die, and that if there's a way that we can die peacefully, maybe, and not alone, you know, not violently and alone, like most suicides, why shouldn't we have the right to that type of good death?
Yeah.
And I think that, and I do understand and respect the, you know, the complexity of it and the resistance to the idea of assisted suicide, but I really think that Canadians are ready to start talking about it, and already have.
I know that your book was the first book by a female author to win Canada Reads. What did that do not only exposure for you as an author, but sort of for literature as a whole?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Canada Reads, it gets a lot of people reading, and that's a great thing. And you know, debate about books is always good. You know, the capital D good. But I think that the risk there is that, you know, a lot of people, like, here's the book that all Canadians should read. I mean, that's an interesting hook, but I mean, there are so many books by Canadians, by non-Canadians, that Canadians should read, and you know, but on the other hand, I mean, it's great if there's one book that they read, and you know, and if they've heard a little bit of the debate. I don't like pitting one book against another, and really, when John Sampson, who defended my book back whenever that was, you know, his strategy was not to attack other books or writers, but just simply to kind of just, like, relentlessly talk about the things that he liked about my book, and so that worked for him.
And I know you also, for A Complicated Kindness, you won the Governor's General Award back in 2004. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, it was really exciting and surprising, and I was and remain so grateful. It allowed me, what it did was, you know, it allowed me some time to work on my next book after that, because, you know, and that's just kind of the fallout of winning a prize like that. And again, you know, it's sort of arbitrary. There's a jury that picks your book, and again, there are so many other worthy books, and so it's just a little bit of a fluke. So you kind of have to, I'm grateful, but you also have to take it with a grain of salt.
Well, the book is All My Puny Sorrows by Miriam Taves, which is out now as of April the 15th. It's a great book. People should check it out. Miriam Taves, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Alrighty, have a good one. Cheers.
Okay, thank you.
And
once again, that was author Miriam Taves. Her new book is All My Puny Sorrows. It's a great read. I highly recommend it. And she was our second Giller Prize nominated writer. We are going to hear another song from Quinn Bishan and Brishan. This is Lady Be Good. Again, that was Brishan with Lady Be Good. My final Giller Prize nominated writer this evening is Padma Vishwanathan, who is the author of The Ever After of Ashwin Rao, which tells the story of Ashwin Rao, a psychologist. It's a fictional story. It tells the story of Ashwin Rao, a psychologist, who deals with victims of the Air India bombing here in Canada 20 years after the fact. It's a very fascinating study, and we talked a lot about the parallels between Air India and 9/11. And I had a chance to speak with Padma.
I'm joined on the phone now by author Padma Vishwanathan. Hello, Padma. Thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So your new book is The Ever After of Ashwin Rao. I'm curious as to why you decided to write a story about, or at least in part about, the Air India bombing, especially given the fact that it took place almost 30 years ago.
Yes, the kernel of the story for me was actually something quite different. I wanted to write about a man, and I do, he's a central figure in the book, Sabe, who's a devotee of a very popular Indian guru. I knew somehow that this man would be a physics professor. I knew that he would have a wife and grown daughters, and that they would not be devotees of the same guru, and indeed would have some kind of skepticism about, say, devotion. This is maybe a year or two after the Air India bombing trial came to its very inconclusive conclusion. in about 2005 or so, and as I was contemplating what could make this man who already seemed quite clear in my mind attach himself to this sort of living incarnation of God, I thought, oh, perhaps he went through the experience of comforting a friend of his to the loss of the friend's wife and son in the Air India bombing, and, you know, underwent this sort of fear by proxy, as happened to so many people in the South Asian community. Even though I myself didn't lose immediate family members in the bombing, most of us are only 1 or 2 degrees of separation from somebody who did. And, you know, my parents came to Canada in the 60s, lived in Western Canada where there were few other Indians, let alone Indians from our own linguistic background. You know, now, 30 years on, people tend to arrive here and find those communities. At that time, they sort of had to make them. And the people that you made friends with at that time, when there were so few of them, became like surrogate family members. And so this was how the story began. It sort of radiated outward from those initial questions about devotion.
What, when it happened, and, you know, especially out here in Vancouver, but also, you know, in other major cities, there's a very large Indo community. And I'm curious, when that event happened back in 85, what was the atmosphere like of the country?
Well, I was a teenager, so I'm only going to really be able to comment on it from that sort of teen bewilderment, right? Sort of observing what my parents were going through. My sense was, I mean, especially for the first, I don't know, 24, 48 hours, there was this intense bewilderment. Nobody knew who could have done this. And of course, there's still speculation. There have been no convictions. Even if there were, people wouldn't necessarily have faith in the results of this trial. It's all very murky. But even as things began to clarify, I think one had the sense in those very early days that you were being made to think about yourself in racial terms in a way that many of us, especially in my generation, hadn't. You know, I grew up in a community where there were very few Indo-Canadians, and while there were racial incidents, mostly we sort of felt ourselves to be walking a line and felt it to be sort of personal. Everybody had their own journey. Suddenly, you felt yourself to be in some way, as I said, racialized, standing out. And I think it was the first major incident in my lifetime where I had to confront the questions of identity in that way.
It's on your website here, and it describes that event, or this book, of post 9/11 Canada. Is that a fair comparison, comparing the Air India bombing to 9/11 in the States?
I mean, statistically, it sure is. Calling it a book of post 9/11 in Canada refers to the trial, and also the basic Canadian immigration policy, of course, shifted post 9/11 to accommodate pressures from the U.S. about how we manage our borders. But certainly, the bombing itself, the Air India bombing, you know, approximately 329 people were killed, almost exactly one-tenth of the number of people who were killed in the Twin Towers, and Canada has about one-tenth of the population of the U.S., so yes, you would think that the losses of Canadian lives were, you know, pretty much equivalent, but of course it wasn't seen that way, it wasn't treated that way at the time. Canada didn't feel as a whole to have been attacked in the way that the U.S. felt it had been, right? And this is one of the things that my narrator, Ashwin Rav, it's one of the beginning points of his investigation. He's a psychologist. He comes to attend the beginning of the trial, and as he sits there, he realizes he has much less interest in the outcome of the trial than he does in the people around him, the bereaved, and those are the ones he wants to know about, especially because there have been many studies done on American psychology in the years since 9/11. There have been very few, in fact, at that time there have been none, done on what happened to these victim families and to the nation as a whole as a result of that bombing in Canada.
Why do you think that is, that this event got considerably less coverage? Is it just the fact that we have a less powerful media than we do today, you know, compared to back then? Is it that we live in Canada and not the U.S.?
I'm not sure that the power of the media has much to do with it. And, of course, I'm not a sociologist. I mean, you're asking me as a novelist to sort of speculate on things that are really the realm of political scientists and sociologists. It's a good question. It's one that I posed in my book. I'm really hoping that, you know, somebody, I have my psychologist take it up in the novel, but I end up fictionalizing what he finds out, perhaps as a result of this book. There will be greater attention paid to this by social scientists, and maybe one of them will come forward with the answers that I myself am seeking.
You mentioned this interview, and even the book talks a lot about sort of, you know, violent politics and racial politics and perhaps, you know, racial sensitivities in dealing with an issue like that. And we saw a lot about that, you know, in the aftermath of 9/11. And I'm curious for you, because you live in the southern U.S. right now, some of the differences you may have noticed in the way racial politics are treated there as opposed to up here in Canada?
Well, racial politics are ever evolving, and of course, as any country becomes more multicultural, the way these things are experienced on both a local and a national level also change, right? I mean, I live in, technically I live in the southern U.S., but I live in the northwest corner of Arkansas, which actually culturally seems in many ways more like the Midwest. I've learned since I came here that there was actually, at the time of the Civil War, equal contingents on each side of that battle from this place. I mean, I think the closer you get to a place, the more problematic in interesting ways, the less generalizable the racial politics are. And of course, that, again, is the territory of the novelist, right? The unexpected ways that such generalities play out in the, you know, unexpected and individual ways, the way they play out in the lives of real people.
I've read that you mentioned you live in Arkansas, Fayetteville, and I read that you live on a hilltop with a bunch of animals. And I'm curious as to what living in an environment like that, what that does for your creative process, as opposed to living in a city like Edmonton.
I see. I live on a hilltop, but Fayetteville is a funky liberal college town, and I can see the university where my husband and I work from my study window. Of course, it is true that we have collected snakes from our yard and bred them in our living room for the entertainment and edification of our children, and this was not an experience that I had growing up in St. Albert, so that is something afforded to us by this place. Arkansas hasn't yet shown up in my creative work, but the town has an environment that is very conducive to it. I mean, it's a friendly place. It is, you know, I mean, I go to my farmer's market. I know everybody on every corner who's there. But honestly, Edmonton felt a bit like that at times, too. I lived on White Avenue as a young adult, and it really felt like, you know, a funky village in the way that Fayetteville does, too.
I'm curious as to, you know, when I talk to authors a lot, it's always fascinating why some choose to write, you know, from the opposite sex or you know, from the same gender that they are. Why did you decide to write this book from a male perspective?
Yeah, I'd be really curious to hear what other novelists say about this kind of thing. My sense is that many of us don't have a very clear sense of our motivations when we begin a project, and so we come up with them retrospectively. I said that Sate sort of came to me fully formed, except that I was very curious about his motivations. I was also aware that he, while he's not based on any individual that I know, various of his qualities do closely resemble a number of the men of my father's generation with whom I grew up, including my dad, including my mother's brother, including several other close family friends I consider to be relatives. And these are Indian men now of a certain age, you know, entering their 70s, whose every thought is really for their family and community, and whose that sort of generosity, Ashwin says it about faith, that it makes him vulnerable in some way. These are men who have traveled such a distance culturally, politically, and otherwise, and I think there was some hunger in me to try to see things through their eyes. Now, of course, I ended up with three men of that generation, Indian men, in my book, and the other two are quite different from Seth. Ashwin is really an intellectual, more prickly, certainly quite sarcastic and obnoxious at times, but he's the one who can give this story the sort of broader political heft that I needed it to have, and that Seth himself, with his very close focus on things so close to him, would not be able to give. And Venkat, the third man, is of course another story entirely.
So how do you, you know, when you're writing it out, how do you sort of think like a man and get inside a male's psyche, which can be very different from that of a woman?
I tend to believe that women are just as different from one another as they are from men. I know we see it as the biggest divide that we have, as something uncrossable, but I really tend to believe in a spectrum of gender, and I'm certainly very close with a lot of men, and I feel like I can see their way of seeing things much more than, again, you know, a number of women. So to me, it sounds sort of like a platitude to say, oh, you know, we're all just people. It's not that. Each of my characters is an individual, and I feel as though I need to dig very deep to try to represent a woman who's very different from me, just in the way that I did to have to represent men who are very different from me. Now, I've already said that Seth resembles in various ways a number of people whom I've known intimately. I've borrowed from them, but of course, you know, the process of writing a novel is a process of plumbing something. I think whether a character is based on you or whether it's based on somebody else or whether you feel you've invented this person whole cloth, regardless, there's a process of excavation you have to follow. And so for me, it was, you know, I haven't written very much at all from an autobiographical perspective, so all of my characters tend to be born from something far enough outside me that I need to find some kind of a line that I can grab onto and sort of hand over hand find their interior life.
Do you think that the Air India case will ever be solved and will ever bring people closure?
Those seem like two separate questions, for one thing, and for another, I mean, I have no idea what other kinds of investigations are going on. My sense about this is, as with 9/11, as with Lockerbie, as with any other sort of mass act of violence, even look at, I live in the States, one has to think about mass shootings, yeah, all the time. And in those cases, even if you know exactly who did it and where, what does closure mean? People have died, they're people who, yeah, are loved, somebody did something horrible, you can never know why. That's false. The pulse, all we can do is, I think it's much more productive to figure out how we can prevent these things and also how to live with them when they happen, how to embrace them in some weird way.
Well, the book is The Ever After of Ashwin Rao. Padma Vishwaswanathan, thanks so much for joining me today.
It was really my pleasure. Thank you for having me on. Thank
Cheers.
You.
Once again, that was Padma Vishwaswanathan, author of The Ever After of Ashwin Rao. And that does it for our Giller Prize special here today. My thanks to Sean Michaels. The book is Us Conductors, as well as Miriam Taves, the author of All My Puny Sorrows, and of course, Padma Vishwanathan, the author of The Ever After of Ashwin Rao. The Giller Prize ceremony will air on November 10th. The other nominees are David Bismosgus for The Betrayers, Francis Itani for Tell, Heather O'Neill for The Girl Who Was Saturday Night. We're going to take you out with a final song from Brishan. This is Musette for Mary. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.